So I want to welcome you all here. So I also want to say that what do DeForest Kelly, who we all better know as Dr. McCoy in Star Trek, Buzz Aldrin, we know as an astronaut, and Bishop Carcano share in common? Today is their birthday, so blessings to you. So I do want to welcome Bishop Minerva Carcano, the Phoenix Area Episcopal Leader, to the group here, and Professor Thomas Frank, who is from Wake Forest University. And frankly, I didn't get to meet all the folks ahead, so wave for the group and make sure I'm introducing the right people. We were hoping that Forbes Madagonia would be here from Zimbabwe, but he's had travel challenges, paperwork challenges that unfortunately delayed him and was not able to be here in time. Tracy Merrick is a lay member from Western Pennsylvania, and has worked with the Methodist Federation for Social Action to look and offer some alternative versions of the change. And Reverend Timothy McClendon, am I saying that right? Is from the Columbia District Superintendent in the South Carolina Annual Conference and is a member of the Connectional Table as well. So I'm just going to verbally, in front of everybody, go our notes here. Our thought is that you each have about 8 minutes, and we have a timekeeper here to help you with that time, for you to share your perspectives and stuff, and then we'll also, after we take our break, you'll be part of our Q&A time, so we'll be able to work all that in. So if that works for you guys, I don't have a particular batting order, but I would defer first to the bishop if you'd like to lead off and share with us.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. Let me move right into it. First, allow me to commend the CT Connectional Table and the Interim Operations Team. They have not only charted a faithful path for the future of the United Methodist Church, but I don't know if you're aware of the fact that they have guided us through the anxious days of the global recession of the last few years. Certainly, one thing we have learned with great clarity is that the world's struggles will not wait for the next General Conference of the United Methodist Church. And we must be bold enough to respond in the in-between time of our imperfect legislative processes guided by the Holy Spirit. So thank you, brothers and sisters, for leading us with courage. Secondly, I want to affirm that so much of the good work that is before us does not have to wait for the action of the 2012 General Conference. This is not a statement intended to discredit the authority of the General Conference, but rather to say that the basic recommendations before us are so fundamental to being the church that they can and should be implemented even now. We are being encouraged to make disciples, to form spiritual leaders, and engage in mission with the fullness of who we are and what we have. This is the work of the church. In the conference I serve, we are working hard even now to align our hearts, hands, and resources with all of you for the sake of a world transformed through the grace and the mercy of Christ Jesus. We are praying for you, and we ask that you would pray for us. Thirdly, I want to briefly point to some areas of our common work that I believe need continued and careful attention. I share these concerns in the spirit that some have labored on our behalf, but now we are all stewards of the work before us. It's the nature of the responsibility given to those of you who have been elected to General Conference to represent United Methodist everywhere. You are now the stewards of the work that has been done thus far. My first concern, the first concern that I would point to, is the need to preserve our connectionalism. I continue to believe that the annual conference is the basic unit of our polity, the best location in our denomination to connect us to do those things we do better together than as individual and separate congregations. Even more, our connectionalism is based on our theological understanding of being members of the body of Christ and not mere individual congregations functioning independently from each other. Under the present recommendations, annual conferences would be free to organize for greater fruitfulness, following similar freedom given to local churches in previous general conferences. There's much to be said about being free to respond to the particular context of mission and ministry that a local church or an annual conference find themselves in. But we must not forget the historic responsibility of the annual conference as the basic unit in our structure. Annual conferences are charged to keeping us connected as United Methodists. I would reference paragraph 610.1 of the Book of Discipline. We must give great care and oversight to how we exercise responsible freedom within a connectional commitment. The second concern that burns my heart is what I continue to experience, not necessarily from these folks who have been working on our behalf, but a sense of a spirit in the church which demonstrates a disregard, an almost disregard for the important function of our general agencies. Several general conferences have struggled with how to align our general agencies to better support our United Methodist mission and ministry. Connectional studies have shown that there is duplication and even competition among our agencies that does not benefit the mission and ministry that God is calling us to be about. Yet general agencies have served a vital function of resourcing the church and enabling us to act connectionally. And we should not lose these important functions. There are things that even our strongest local churches cannot do alone, and some things that they will not do. And these are things that the general agencies can help us to come together to do. In what seems to be a lack of our attention to some of these matters, I see the disregard for the important function of the agencies. But let me give you some other examples. Consider the list of the proposed general agency functions. The list of functions I have seen under those proposed offices for leadership excellence, congregational vitality, missional engagement and justice, and reconciliation seem to reflect drop boxes, where everything we have done thus far through general agencies has simply been dropped without obvious, or at least to me, clear thought to what we can let go of because it may no longer be helpful, nor clear thought to the addition of some new things that may be more relevant to the needs of the present age. We need to create space for an ongoing and prayerful conversation between our brothers and sisters whom we have asked to lead our general agencies and all of us as to how we will align and redirect the work of our general agencies. At the same time, there's also legislation that proposes that during the new quadrennium, $60 million will be redirected. If the work of the agencies does not change any more than being placed in different columns and funding is redirected, I'm concerned that we may lay unreasonable expectations on our agencies, crippling their efforts, and that in the process we may lose some critical functions and ministries that serve the connection and its work that we would not want to lose. Finally, in this section, I am also concerned that after many, many years, I have yet to hear an in-depth connectional conversation about the fact that the present programmatic general agencies were established, with the exception of the General Board of Global Ministries, to serve the U.S. church. As we have moved into being a more global church, there have been growing expectations, and rightfully so, that our general agencies will serve this global church. Such a shift from U.S. to global, however, requires an intentional change of focus and a sharing of resources that should be done thoughtfully and strategically and not reactively, or we will render our general agencies unsustainable. Finally, the third concern that I would raise is the absence of a clear commitment to reaching out to people of color. Friends, in the U.S., a church that does not reach out to people of color is a church that will die. It is both a demographic and a spiritual reality. We do not seem to see the critical importance, and this is a confession I believe for myself and all of us, not just these two bodies that have worked for us. We have not yet seen the critical importance to truly open ourselves to people of color. I applaud what I saw in November, which I didn't see today, on the chart, on the proposed structure, governance structure, of a highly visible and power-connected advisory committee on ministry with young people. A similar advisory committee should be established for ministry with people of color. As chair of the National Plan for Hispanic Latino Ministry, I kept asking, what will our commitment to people of color, where will our commitment to people of color be visible in the proposed organizational legislation? I kept being assured that it would be there. I continue to trust that we will do it. It was, however, not until this last fall that I finally saw it. And unless it's changed, it was at the tail end of the list under the drop box of the Office of Congregational Vitality, and it was called Multicultural Ministries. Now, I do not know what multicultural ministries means. I do not know the work that is expected or what is hoped for. I am unaware of any of our national plans for racial ethnic ministries being consulted about what would be helpful in reaching out to people of color. But I do know that the church will be less than faithful if it does not address its inability thus far to make room for people of color in this church, and it will be poor for it. Brothers and sisters, I believe that our connectional table and IOT have brought us thus far. I believe that they have done good work, but I believe that the task is massive and complex, and now it is our turn to take up the task and with them to keep perfecting it. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. It is great to be with you and to enjoy the fellowship of old friends and new as we gather to get ready for General Conference. I'm Tom Frank. I teach at Wake Forest University. And I can't help feeling a little conspicuous as I look through the program. There's only a couple of us that have as our primary calling in ministry to be teachers and scholars for the church. That makes me feel both grateful to be asked for my perspective and a little conspicuous as somebody who's not a delegate, not on an agency, not a pastor or superintendent. Then again, I think I was asked here to do my job, which as a scholar is to try to ask good questions, good searching, critical questions that will help advance our church in the directions we want it to go. And I invite you to join me in asking good questions. And I want to pose two kinds of questions for conversation this morning that arise out of my teaching and writing about United Methodist traditions and polity, and then more broadly in the field of church leadership and administration. So, first set of questions. What are the principles of polity on which a general church structure should be based? To explore this question, we need to turn first and foremost to the Constitution of the United Methodist Church. And I really urge you as delegates to study this document again and again in preparation for your return to Tampa. I think there are five principles of polity that have an impact on our thinking about what kind of structure we want. The first principle, of course, is the principle of conference. Methodists make decisions together, in conference, in conversation that's a means of grace. Methodism and United Methodism has never had a central executive body that has powers over mission, money, and ministries of the whole church. Frustrating as it has always been, the General Conference only meets every 4 years, and I have found complaints about this dating back before 1900, no single body has ever been created, the powers and duties of which include acting for the whole connection between sessions of General Conference. The only agencies General Conference has ever created are completely amenable to General Conference. That is, they can't do anything beyond what General Conference has authorized them to do. Second principle, episcopacy. It's Division 2 of the Constitution. Constitutionally, on equal footing with conference, is the principle of oversight, episcopos, episcopacy. Methodists, excepting the Methodist Protestant branch, have always been guided by the oversight of bishops. presiders of our conferences, superintendents of our ministries, leaders of our mission, our principal preachers and advocates of our connectional covenants, whose constant travel and persuasive presence knits us together as a connection. The Constitution spells out very little of this oversight function. It just calls it in general oversight of the spiritual and temporal affairs of the church. We have, to a great extent, left episcopal practices to the initiative of our bishops acting as a council of bishops. Third principle, separation of powers. Thus, the Constitution clearly sets out a separation of conference and episcopal powers, intended to make each of them able to make its distinctive contribution to the church. Annual conferences do not elect their own presidents, nor do they make the bishop into a CEO answerable to them. No conference can delegate to a bishop the executive power to carry out a mandate. Bishops cannot legislate or impose themselves as managers of conference programs. Remember that every annual conference restructure plan that Judicial Council has reviewed in the last 15 years has had to meet this constitutional test of separation of powers. Inclusiveness, the fourth principle. Inclusiveness is what our Constitution calls it, though I've never really liked the implication of this term that somebody's already in the inside, including others. I prefer participation, the church's ideal that all members have the right and the opportunity to participate fully in the life of the church. Of course, Methodists have never had sheer radical democracy. We have always believed in conference, that is, delegated or representative conference, and thus the right of all constituencies of the church to be represented. The UMC in its 44 years has gone all out to ensure this principle in anything controlled by General Conference, in particular by mandating that constituencies in the minority of our membership have enough critical mass in our boards and agencies to have an effective voice. That's the 30% rule. This has become part of our DNA, I think. Any unit or body that gathers to do official work without ethnic diversity at the table seems weird, incomplete, unjust and unworkable. Fifth principle, fiduciary duty and the distinction of program and finance. This principle is less visible in the Constitution than it is in the long-standing legislative provisions of our Book of Discipline, in every body from local church to general agency. Authority over program is not to be mixed with authority over money. The powers of money management are not to be confused with powers over initiatives in ministry and mission. Separation of the two prevents consolidation of power and advances accountability and participation. The United Methodist Church is hardly alone in this principle. It's basic to the functioning of any legitimate nonprofit corporation or non-governmental organization. A distinct body accounts for the finances and avoids programmatic initiative. A distinct body initiates program and mission and does not write the checks that pay for it. So here are five key principles of polity. There may be more that you'd want to consider. And I think legislation of the scope being proposed needs to meet these constitutional tests. And whether or not this proposal meets these tests, I think is a matter for searching conversation. And I pose these questions to provoke that conversation. Is the proposed Center for Connectional Ministry and Mission an executive agency for the whole church? Appropriate language of amenability to General Conference is included in the proposed paragraph 704 in the legislative proposal. At the same time, the center has sweeping powers and duties of management over the vast majority of General Conference work. How will this function on the ground? Will such a center have to take, inevitably, actions deemed necessary under a General Conference mandate that gets really too broad to provide any meaningful accountability? A second question. Does the proposed center conflate powers over money with powers over program? How would these be separated in practice, especially if the Constitution is changed so that an oversight council that oversees program can also move money around? And a third question, can a center with a single CEO and governing board and practice of really meeting regularly, 15 people, adequately represent the multiple constituencies and interests of the United Methodist Church? How will those interests be represented in the center's work? My second set of questions, let me abbreviate for the sake of time. These are more organizational questions, matters of administrative practice that I think it's worth thinking about. Will the proposed restructure accomplish its desired ends or achieve exactly the opposite of what it intends? I think that's a great question to ask of any proposal. Will it achieve its intentions or actually have the opposite effect? The same impulse to consolidate and achieve economies of scale drove the general agency restructure when the United Methodist Church was created 44 years ago. A plan of four general boards was going to increase efficiency and accountability, consolidate duplicative efforts, and lead to greater coordination. Read the presentations from the minutes of the 1972 General Conference. The call to action decries this old plan as bureaucracy and calls for streamlined connectional structures. I think we have to ask, will putting all general agency powers and duties under a single center advance accountability, break down organizational distance and growing lack of trust that was identified in the very fine report by APEX that's available online? I urge you to read that too. Or will it actually end up growing even more features of bureaucracy that we profess not to like, such as top-down directives to annual conferences and congregations, or the, quoting, prescriptive rule-based culture and environment, unquote, that the APEX report notes? A second question, and I'll stop with this. Is the proposed restructure right-sized for an organization of the scale and complexity of the United Methodist Church? This proposal bears a lot of resemblance to the restructure of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America that was adopted last year in 2011. It's available on their ELCA website. I encourage you to look at it. That denomination also consolidated its general church work into five offices under a church council of about 45 members authorized to act on behalf of the churchwide assembly that meets every 2 years, I believe. It's nice to be on the same wavelength as other Protestants, except the ELCA is less than half our size, with about 10,000 congregations and 4.2 million baptized members in the United States. Is our proposed structure complex enough to be supple and responsive to the many varied constituencies of the UMC scattered across the globe? When I read through 220 pages of legislation spelling out the duties of our general agencies, I have to ask, can one council of 15 people and one executive secretary adequately grasp the breadth, history, nuances, and manifold tasks that we want these agencies to carry out? And if we have to stop doing some things, who will be knowledgeable enough to make decisions about reordering the work of what is now nine different agencies with multiple specialized offices? The APEX report question that stands out for me the most is the one, who is going to lead change in the church? That's the question that jumps out for me. The connectional table, call to action, the council bishops have stepped up to this challenge with a complete restructure idea. Now it's up to you to ask good questions, have probing, critical conversations, and act. Thanks.
I'm Tim McClendon. I'm a member of the Connectional Table, was also on the legislative writing team, was chair of the legislative writing team the previous quadrennium. I want to offer my thanks to Jay Brim and Rich Peck and all the members of the Connection Table and Interim Operations Team for their fine work in leading us to this place. And I mean that. I know it's a work in progress, and I know that the legislative committee and the plenary sessions at the General Conference, as we gather back here, will deal with all of these issues more thoroughly. But I do want to raise some questions. But before I raise the questions, I do want to say once again thanks to the groups that have brought us to this place. I'm reminded of Wayne Gretzky, the great one, the best hockey player of all time, who said, "Don't skate to where the puck is. Skate to where the puck is going to be, and you'd have to be an idiot to skate to where it used to be." I think we all agree that we need to go where the puck is going. The future, whatever that future might look like. The IoT-CT plan is one way to get to where the puck is going, but here are just a few issues, and certainly not all of them. And I want us to skate where the puck is going without unnecessary or unintended consequences. I lifted the prelude to my first concern yesterday about the balance of powers. Dr. Frank has already covered that as well, but I do want to talk about this a little bit further. I call this balanced progress. We want to move forward, but without fouling up our denominational self-understanding. Simply put, we have a balance of power between our two constitutive principles of episcopacy and conferences. We want bishops to lead per paragraph 427.3, but not so much that they can't speak at general conference without the plenary's permission. Interesting dichotomy. Only the general conference can speak for the denomination, paragraph 509.1 and .2. But the problem is that there are 4 years between general conferences, and to be relevant, you have to be current. How do we handle the tension? Do we give more power to the bishops or to the general conference? I've already expressed my assessment and that of others that every church split, except the racial splits that we've had in our denomination, have occurred because either the bishops or the general conference were favored too much in the power balance. This vision of a power balance has been upheld by the Judicial Council as recently as 2001 and 2010. Judicial Decision 689 from 2001 says, and I quote, "The separation of authority and decision-making is integral in the United Methodist Constitution and law. While the boundaries can become hazy in any particular situation, the preservation of the separation of powers must be observed." In 2010, Judicial Decision 1156 stated in the context of separating the powers of an annual conference and a bishop, quote, "Our decision is made against the backdrop of three guiding principles. The operative principles of United Methodist polity include the authority of the annual conference, the separation of powers, and fair process." For instance, the upshot of these rulings means that if a board of ordained ministry in an annual conference approves a clergy person, and then they are approved by the clergy session at the annual conference, then a bishop has to ordain them. There is no option not to. They cannot reverse it. That separation of powers, conference and episcopacy. But let's look at fair process for a second. And the separation of powers as found in the IoT and CT legislation. How does the power dynamic in the legislation tilt in favor of the episcopacy? Now, I need to say this at this point. None of this is addressed at any of the bishops. This is not personal. This is about polity and ecclesiology. Please hear that. I appreciate our episcopal leadership. The IoT legislation proposes a set-aside bishop who is president of the Council of Bishops, and don't forget that that position also makes this person chair of the 45-member General Council for Strategy and Oversight and an ex officio member of the 15-member Board of Directors of the United Methodist Center for Connectional Mission and Ministry. Here's where the proposal really gets dicey for me from an ecclesiological point of view. This collusion of roles has huge implications in setting budgets for the denomination. Right now, the bishops have nothing to do with the setting of the United Methodist Church's budget. It's all done by GCFA and the connectional table. Bishops only have input in a church-wide appeal that occurs between sessions of the General Conference in consultation with the connectional table and the General Council on Finance and Administration. But in this plan, not only does the CCMM, the Center for Connectional Mission and Ministry, have control over $870 million in fixed assets, plus somewhere near $200 million in assets like land and buildings, but also they would have ultimate control over the $603 million budget of the General Conference, plus have power to reallocate the World Service and General Administration amounts of that budget between sessions of the General Conference. Also, out of the regular budget, the Council of Bishops and the General Council of Strategy and Oversight can reallocate up to $60 million affecting not only World Service or General Administration, but also ministerial education, and we want to help our young clergy and all of our clergy with their debt load. But that reallocation power can reduce the amount of ministerial education, the funds for Africa University, the funds for the black colleges, the Interdenominational Cooperation Fund, and the Episcopal Fund. And good luck with that. This is all done through shared consultation, according to the legislation with the Council of Bishops, between the Council of Bishops and the General Council on Strategy and Oversight. But I dare bring up the fact that it doesn't seem like a fair fight. The legislation is found in proposed paragraphs 906, A, B, and D on page 29 of the legislation. There are 69 active bishops in the United Methodist Church with voice and vote, and there are 83 retired bishops with voice. That's a total of 152. There are 40 members of the General Council of Strategy and Oversight that aren't bishops, and the GCSO meets only once a year. The power dynamic isn't equal any way one does the math. The 15-member connectional, the Center for Connectional Ministry is comprised of volunteers that handle the entire decision-making about somewhere around $2 billion in assets, just reachable assets, in consultation with the Council of Bishops. It seems apparent to me that as the 15-member CCMM, in consultation with the GCSO and the Council of Bishops, it seems apparent to me that there's no way for those 15 persons who are unpaid volunteers, however great they are at all that they do, there's no way for them to make these kinds of decisions. It also seems to me that the set-aside bishop represents where the real power is in the proposed structure, the Council of Bishops. Our denominational balance of powers has turned on its head and has never been done this way. And I know there's time that we should do some things, but this, I don't think, is one of them. Let me be clear. Right now, the General Conference sets the budget, and there is no reallocation between General Conference sessions. In this proposal, there will be reallocations primarily simply by doing the math that will occur because of the influence of the Council of Bishops. These are new powers given to the COB with huge ramifications that will upset any balance of power between the General Conference and the Council of Bishops. Giving this much power to the Council of Bishops is like a local church council meeting setting a budget, and then in between their meetings, the local pastor having the ability to say, well, that was a good idea, but I disagree. I think we ought to spend it this way. I really think that's not good. Yes, I agree that we all want and need in this economic climate more fiscal accountability to be able to act in a more nimble way and a more timely way than a quadrennial meeting allows. But the power to make these changes has to be equitably shared. The balance of powers is also an issue when one starts talking about a set-aside bishop. We do not have a monarchical view of the episcopacy. It may be a practical matter to free up a bishop from residential duties in an annual conference, but to do that so it somehow helps us fulfill the adaptive challenge seems a little disingenuous. Annual conferences by discipline are the primary place where a bishop is needed. Paragraph 11, paragraph 33, paragraph 369.1, all say that the annual conference is either the basic or the fundamental body of the church. And yet we want a set-aside bishop who is another step farther removed. And then there's the notion that the bishops can hold one another accountable, and that the set-aside bishop can really do that. Nice thought, but all bishops are bishops. All bishops are elders who are consecrated for a particular task, and constitutionally, not one bishop can tell another bishop what that bishop should or could do. I love our bishop, but this changes our basic ecclesiology. Now, I want to share briefly, just very briefly, the litigation problems that I see that arise in this legislation. Increased liability is a real specter. Too many people have forgotten or have never heard of the Pacific Homes case that lasted from the 1970s to the 1990s in the UMC. Tim Tanton of the United Methodist News Service, who is here, wrote the last article about this issue, and it's worth reading. Just Google Tim Tanton and Pacific Homes, and you'll find it. Anyway, what happened is that a lower court said the denomination could not be sued for the Pacific Homes default on its promise to provide lifetime care to residents, but a higher court said that the whole denomination was liable. As a result of this case, language was added to the Book of Discipline to protect us from litigation and affirm our historic self-understanding that we are a movement more than an institution. Paragraphs 140 and paragraph 2509 of the Book of Discipline were added to spell this out. Paragraph 140 says about the UMC in part that the church is not an entity, nor does it possess legal capacities or attributes. It does not and cannot hold title to property, nor does it, and listen to this as you think about a set-aside bishop and a Center for Connectional Mission and Ministry, nor does it have any officer, agent, employee, office, or location. And paragraph 2509 says, because of the nature of the United Methodist Church, no individual or affiliated church body or unit, nor any official thereof, may commence or participate any suit in any suit on behalf of the United Methodist Church. It goes on to say that we are a non-jural entity. That is, we cannot be sued or be sued. Two things are important. Our nature as a church is to have deployed mission outposts, whether it's local churches, annual conference, general agencies, etc. Our nature is to be passion-driven as an organism, not an organization. My brothers and sisters, I believe that by going to this streamlined model, efficient as it may appear, will actually cause us to be more open to those persons who might want to bring litigation against us. We need to ponder all of the questions, and there are many, many more ecclesiological and practical questions. I would love to have this conversation with any of you, and I'm sure the rest of us would as well. We will be in holy conferencing together, trying to find the things that work. There's so much good in the call to action report, and I don't want to toss it out, but I want to raise questions.
My name is Tracy Merrick. I'm from Western Pennsylvania, and I'm here on behalf of the Methodist Federation for Social Action. I hope that you have a copy of the document which was handed out earlier today, because I'm going to be referring to it in a couple of moments. First of all, I would really like to thank the organizers of this event for giving us an opportunity to present something that has been near and dear to our hearts for quite some time. I'd also like to thank the Connectional Table and some of the entities that have put out a document that is a place for us to start our discussion. And we would just like to make sure that the discussion continues. After the Connectional Table report or proposal was adopted, some folks from the Methodist Federation for Social Action, MFSA, gathered and began to discuss it. And we discovered that in addition to some concerns and thoughts about that report, we also had some issues with the ministry study report as well as the report of the study committee on the worldwide nature of the church. And we discovered some overlapping themes that I'd like to share through the course of this presentation. As is common around the United Methodist Church, we could have sat around and expressed concerns to each other endlessly, but we decided that we would envision what a new structure might look like. And we thought, well, wouldn't it be novel if we developed a proposal of our own to submit as something for consideration? And so that's what we did. And there are three components to it. One is dealing with restructuring. One is dealing with the worldwide nature of the church. And a third component deals with clergy evaluation. My purpose for being here today is to talk about the restructuring proposal. Our goal was to prepare an alternative which addressed the concerns that we had and also would be something that would begin dialogue before, during, and after a general conference across the whole church, which would be broad-based. And we hope that that's what occurs. So what did we envision? And I suspect as I go through some of these concepts that many of you would agree with them also. We see a structure that supports the United Methodist Church in its mission to make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world. But we would encourage, as we think about that concept, that we also look at paragraph 122 of the discipline, which broadens the concept of disciple-making. I would encourage you to look at it. It's a very inspirational paragraph, if you find the discipline inspirational. We also think that as we think about metrics, that we ought to consider metrics that are consistent with some of the other provisions that are in that paragraph. We envision a structure that ensures greater levels of diversity, top to bottom. Our proposal for a number of the boards that we're suggesting suggests 40% people of color and 20% folks who are young adults and youth. We envision a structure that includes larger decision-making bodies and governance boards than the CT proposal, that will encourage and engage broader-based holy conferencing and collaboration. We also think that larger bodies are necessary for folks to understand the entire scope of our denomination. That can't happen, in our views, with a small group of 15 or even 45 members. We also think it's important to distribute the decision-making as it regards matters of finance, to separate those functions. We envision a structure that embraces central conference participation more completely in the life of our denomination. We believe that one of the most significant issues which the denomination must address is the need for a major culture shift that will view all United Methodists around the world as equal members of one body, known as the United Methodist Church, that will recognize vital ministries, cultural differences, and ecumenical interreligious relationships that exist across the whole denomination. If you look at some of the proposals, you'll notice that in terms of Central Conference participation, right now about 36% of the members of United Methodist Churches live outside the United States. The Council on Strategy and Oversight in the CT proposal would allocate 11% of the members of that body to central conferences. By comparison, the Southeast jurisdiction with 24% of the membership in the denomination would have more seats on that body than all the central conferences combined. We believe in our envisioning that independence needs to be given to certain entities because of their important monitoring and advocacy roles, notably the General Commission on Religion and Race and the General Commission on the Role and Status of Women. As they are important entities as we deal with issues of systemic racism and systemic sexism. We also envision providing greater opportunities for participation by all laity and clergy across the denomination in these larger bodies that we're proposing. This will enable us to take advantage of the incredible giftedness that God has distributed across the denomination in ways that we don't think are present in the CT proposal. We do agree with the concept of downsizing, and I like Tom's reference to the word right-sizing. Because in downsizing but right-sizing, we don't sacrifice some of the important components that we think are necessary in our proposal. If you will turn to this sheet, I would like to briefly walk through the document with you. On page one, you'll notice that it includes a coordinating council with four centers that will work collaboratively with the coordinating council. And the purpose of that council is a forum for coordination of the mission, ministries, and resources of the agencies of the United Methodist Church. I would hasten to add quickly that there's a typo in the box in the lower left-hand corner under Center for Resourcing of Operations, where it lists GCFA, the General Board of Pension and Health Benefits, and GCOM. That's meant to be UMCOM. You'll see that on page two, it's reflected correctly. If you'll turn to page two with me, you'll see that the information regarding the four centers is indicated there, and the makeup of the boards. You'll notice that we are proposing significantly more Central Conference representation than the CT report does with its entities. And some of the other provisions that I mentioned a moment ago are there as well. GCCUIC would be incorporated into the Council of Bishops, which is consistent with the CT proposal, and there would be six independent agencies. Now, I do hasten to add a question. Is our proposal perfect? Absolutely not. But it is a proposal for us to work on together. For instance, there would be very good reason to move the General Board of Pension and Health Benefits up as an independent agency. Those are all perfections that can occur as we continue our dialogue in terms of what structure makes sense for our denomination. We hope this plan is a proactive first step. We hope this plan reflects the vision and hopes that we have for our denomination. We hope that it's a viable alternative that will be worthy of incorporation into the mix of the discussion. And we hope, without a doubt, that it will begin the process of continuing broad-based, open dialogue about what our structure should look like. May the dialogue begin. May the dialogue continue. Thank you very much.